gives me a new peace of mind. I stand in his promise and in his grace. Glory, glory, he is my peace. What he promised, he will do. I'm blessed with it.
Hey guys, I got about 45 seconds left. That's Sister Makanja with a song entitled I'm Blessed. And before that was Brother Jeffrey Allen Scott with a song entitled Get Ready. So I'm just about out of here. I've had a great time. I hope you've enjoyed the 30 minutes again. We'll see you back next week.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Is autism an epidemic? Or is it a superpower? Are you a little bit on the spectrum? Or are you hashtag actually autistic? I'm Carrie Stewart Lingle, host of NeuroEmergent. Join me from 11 a.m. to noon on the fourth Wednesday of every month to explore neurodiversity in the Pacific Northwest and beyond, right here on KBOO Community Radio.
Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. And talk about cultural evolution, that's what we're going to talk about today. It's how might the world change if those who consciously nurture relationship were rewarded for the value that they create. And there are powerful institutions from schools to high tech to social media companies that are creating breeding grounds for isolation because they're failing to invest in relational work, or so says our guest in today's program. This economic and political obstacle stands in the way of our fight for racial equity, economic justice, and climate resilience. And today we're talking with an author and activist who believes in the power of relationship and wants to see increased investment in relational work. Our guest today is David Jay, author of the new book, Relationality, with a subtitle, How Moving from Transactional to Transformational Relationships Can Reshape Our Lonely World. David is a community organizer with a background in physics. He was born and raised in St. Louis, Missouri. From founding the Asexual Visibility and Education Network to working in the heart of the tech reform movement, David has centered the work of building relationship as a tool for healing and driving social change. He researches and writes about why these important relational tools so often go underappreciated and underfunded, and how that reality might change. David is regularly invited to speak at conferences and universities on topics ranging from asexuality to movement organizing, to tech reform, to queer family structure. David lives with his two co-parents and two children in Oakland, California. And hello, David, and welcome to the Pathway Show.
It is such an honor to be here with you today. I'm really excited for this conversation.
Well, me too, because your book is very unique and you are very unique. And it occurs to me, and I'm just going to ask this right off the bat, that you are redefining, or just maybe clearly defining for the first time, this word relationship. And can you speak to that? You know, what do you mean by that the way you use that word.
So I will give myself a little less credit. I think that there are many wonderful definitions of relationship out there. And I will just briefly say I spent a good chunk of my life coming to understand this word, coming to understand the power of this concept. When I was younger, I struggled a lot with loneliness. And part of the path out of loneliness for me, especially as an asexual person, was to say, I think the definition of relationship I've been given, the idea that a relationship just exists when we have a romantic partnership, like that definition is too narrow. I want something with more room to breathe and more room to explore and more room to be creative. And so the definition I came to, which has been very powerful in my life and is inspired a lot by the work of Octavia Butler, if you're familiar with her work, is that a relationship exists when we change one another. The more powerfully we change one another, the stronger the relationship is. The longer that change persists over time, the more powerful that relationship is. And I like that definition because it means that we can be in a little bit of relationship with every being in the universe, and then we have these deeper, stronger, more direct relationships with some people. And I also like that definition because it speaks to how relationship both transforms us. Relationship is a core part of how we change, and relationship is a core part of how we are resilient. I remember, okay. Being a young parent. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, aren't you just talking about friendship, which is a very important form of relationship for sure?
I think friendship is one form of relationship. I think about a relationship as anything that's changed me. So my relationship with my daughter is one of the most, and my son, are two of the most powerful, profound relationships in my life. Like, not only have they transformed who I am, but when I have a hard day, when I have a great day, like whatever kind of day I have, I come back and they sort of bring me back to center. They add a resilience to my life because they change me back to the balanced person that I want to be when the world sort of puts me off kilter. So I have, friendships with people. I have relationships I'm in movement with. I have deep committed partnerships that are non-romantic and non-sexual because I'm asexual and aromantic. I have relationships with land. I have spiritual relationships. There's so many different kinds of relationships that can change us and where we can change others.
And do people have a problem forming relationships, or is that related to the loneliness crisis that you refer to?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we are really in an ahistorical moment where we are helping people with this really important work of forming relationships a lot less than we have at most points in human history. As an advocate and activist, I work on a lot of things, but the loneliness crisis and the intersection of loneliness with everything from a democracy to a climate is where a lot of my activism is really centered. It is clear, we've seen statistics from all around the world, that the rate of loneliness is increasing. The number of people who say they have no one they can go to with a serious problem is increasing. And what we're seeing is that loneliness has dramatic effects everywhere from our bodies. So being lonely, severe loneliness is the same as smoking, I think, 13 cigarettes a day, to the health of our democracies are being impacted by this loneliness. So it is a really deep systemic problem. And I think something we can do something about.
I think your book really does a service in a philosophical sense, because you are broadening the whole understanding of relationship. Because like you said, usually when you see that word, especially if it's a capital R, it's implying this romantic connection. And so maybe, and that's considered to be the be all and end all. I call it the romantic paradigm. The fact that if you meet the perfect person at the perfect time and they fall in love with you at the same time, you might have this glorious destiny. And people just really are addicted to that fantasy. It really dominates our conception of relationship and creates a kind of a hierarchy. And I love that you are taking issue with that and broadening the playing field.
Thank you so much. And I think as someone who identifies asexual, who grew up asexual, that was a survival tactic for me. I think things are different now, but when I was younger, when I was in my 20s, all my friends were dating. That was sort of how you had relationships that were committed, that you could count on, that were serious. And I just couldn't do that. I was not compatible with the infrastructure. I was undateable. And the world told me, okay, if you can't date, you are going to be alone forever. That is the only possible outcome. And me and a bunch of other people from the ACE community said, we don't think that's true. We think we can redefine relationship to create room for us. And I really learned to invite intentionality into my relationships, to go on these walks with my friends and say, look, we're not in a romantic relationship, but this relationship matters to me. And let's just talk about the unique, powerful role that this connection plays in both of our lives. And I found that when I could add that intentionality to my relationships, they really transformed. They became, not only do we have the ability to talk about the relationship in the relationship, but they became a site of collective care. And that care has been incredibly transformative in my life.
Yeah. You know, I think what enters into things for so many people in our culture at large is the fact that they're trying to get emotional needs met in a relationship. That's why the romantic paradigm has so much power, is because it promises that. It promises unconditional love, which we were entitled to when we were infants, but if we didn't get it sufficiently, we've been looking for it in romantic connection, interpersonal connections ever since. And that is a powerful, powerful primordial longing that humans are wired with. But what about you? I mean, what does it mean to be asexual? I'm asking totally innocently. Does that, you know, don't you have that romantic desire ever?
I love that you brought up what's primal for us. So I'll define asexuality. I'm asexual. That means that I experience little to no sexual attraction. So most people, when they, you know, at some point in a relationship, feel a desire to integrate sexuality into it. I just don't feel that intrinsic desire. But I still have the same deep need for emotional intimacy, the same deep need for human connection that everyone else has. And I think, like most humans through most of human history, I meet that need through community. I think for most of human history, we might have had a romantic partner who was an important part of how we met that need. But the notion that you would only rely on your romantic partner, you would not also have a committed community of people around you, I think that is deeply ahistorical. And for me, there's a lot of return to a lineage of, like, we never used to raise kids just two adults in a house. We never used to think that just showing up for yourself and your family was a sufficient way to feel emotionally grounded and connected. Like, community has been a really deep part of our history, and finding ways to bring back that skill of intentionally building community of relationships, investing in a community of care with just as much intention as we might invest in a romantic partnership, because the two really need one another, or at least the romantic partnership, I think, needs a community around it to be successful. That's something I've been thinking about a great deal.
And so this, do you think that this is an evolutionary need now that we have isolated ourselves in big cities, ironically, whereas we used to have this built-in community with the extended family in the village?
I think how we meet our needs for community can evolve. And I don't think cities are the problem. Like, people move to cities to seek relationship a lot of the time. I think cities can be a beautiful place to seek relationship. I think the problem has to do with the fact that we have stopped recognizing the work it takes to build places where people connect. So I think about, if someone's lonely, one of the most powerful things to give them is a place to show up. That could be...
I was going to say, isn't that what Facebook was trying to do?
No, but, and I go into this in my book, I work a lot actually with Facebook employees. Like, Facebook fundamentally failed to be that place, right? You need a place, ideally offline, where you can show up on, ideally on a regular basis. Ideally, people recognize you, see you, get to know your story when you show up there. Ideally, some part of you that doesn't get seen other places can get seen there. Ideally, you show up, maybe you do some activity together, but after the activity, there's food and just sort of casual time where you can get to know people a little bit better. Like, those sorts of spaces where there's ample room to get to know people and build new relationships. That is a really, really critical form of infrastructure. One that people who are fighting the loneliness crisis, like myself, really think about, okay, how do we get resources? How do we get support to this really critical work of building sites of connection, building relational containers?
But that is what social media was intending to do. You're just saying that it's a failed experiment. It's not delivering the promised land.
So, really interesting story. This comes from my book. Facebook had a whole internal project to try to define what social connection was. They were looking for a definition of relationship. And they came onto something called meaningful social interactions, where they said, and there's a bunch of ways they got to it, but it wasn't, do people who connect on Facebook go to connect in other ways outside of Facebook that are meaningful in their lives? It was, do people like and share a post? If they're liking and sharing things, then that must mean that they're becoming better friends. So everything became about engagement. It became about sending out a message and then competing to see who could get the most engagement for their posts. That's true on Instagram. That's true on TikTok.
And that's just another word for attention.
And so when you have a lot of people competing for attention, it's a really bad environment to build relationships. What you need are these protected little spaces where people can go deep, where they're not visible to the entire world because that's too vulnerable, where they don't need to compete for attention. The fact they've shown up as a human is enough to have them feel, to have them be seen. More spaces like that, I think, are much better for building relationship. And social media, the business model just doesn't support it being that kind of a space.
Okay. So what can we do about that? I mean, when you talk about in your book and you use this term relational work, now I don't know whether does that imply that relationship is work, or is that about the work that we need to do in order to create these containers that we need?
I'll share an example if I can of what I mean by that. So my brother just moved to a new city. And he, like everyone, I think he's more aware of this. He's like, I know I need community to be happy. I need to have friends. I don't have friends. I have my wife, but I don't have friends in this new city. So he said, I have a plan. I'm going to find a game store near my house. The game store is going to have like every Thursday game night, board game night. I'm going to go religiously to the every Thursday board game nights. And then after the board game, I'm going to offer to get people tacos. And we're going to like have a space where we eat food together, and I'm seeing the same people and eating food with them. And then within the first 2 months, I want to have invited those people over to my house for dinner. And that absolutely worked. It was taking a kind of small space where he shared passion with people. It was inviting people to connect more deeply out of that space. It was the work of the game store to convene that space in the first place. But relational work is all of the work that goes into creating the times and places where connection happens.
Wow, I like that. It's all, you know, it's kind of an aspect of event management in a way. I mean, putting on dinner parties and stuff like that. I mean, anybody can do that.
Yeah, and I think there's always, you know, I like the story of my brother because there's always like a little baby step to make something more relational. Maybe you go to a yoga class, you see the same people every week, but it just takes a little invitation for people to hang out after the class to have it be a thing where people are sort of ships passing to something where there's room for relationship, room for friendship to grow.
And to what extent do you think that the romantic paradigm gets in the way of people connecting in a healthy way with other people, particularly other people of a different gender.
So I think the romantic paradigm gets in the way when it feels like the only option. One, when if I connect with someone and I feel there's potential, and then I say, oh, either this is going to be a romantic relationship or it's going to be nothing.
Right.
And that puts a lot of pressure on the relationship. And mm-hmm. there's a lot of reasons why if that doesn't become my one, or, you know, if I'm poly, my one of a few romantic relationships, then it certainly goes away. If I can say, I feel energy with this person, I feel connection with this person, and there's a lot of places that might go. Maybe one of them is romantic, if that makes sense, but there's other equally, you know, very powerful and appealing options that are not that, and I'm ready to be really excited about those options too. I think it creates a lot more abundance mm-hmm. in our capacity to connect with people,
right?
And puts less pressure on that, like, I have to be romantic with this person, or they're going to be gone from my life forever.
You know, I've personally, and I think collectively, we've been seriously brainwashed by the romantic paradigm, you know, with ever since the beginning of dating, and in the 1800s, the Industrial Revolution, people moved into cities, and all of a sudden we had this new phenomenon called love matches. And ever mm-hmm. since then, it's just been glorified by poetry and movies and books and songs. And Disney, and you know, you grow up with that's kind of the water you swim in. It has an effect, and I'm wondering, how the hell did you get to be a romantic? Did you have to like work at that, or how is it that you escaped that conditioning?
I hope you don't mind me asking. No, that's fine. I talked a little bit about what it means to be asexual. For me, aromantic is a parallel identity. There are some people who are asexual, like me, asexual and aromantic. You have people who are aromantic but not asexual, or asexual but very romantic. Aromantic to me means that I don't have an intense rush of feelings at the beginning of a relationship. I see someone and I say, oh, this person adds, you know, a relationship with this person could add a thing that I'm looking for in my life. I'm going to make time. I'm going to be a yes to them. I'm going to be a yes to time with them. I know why I'm a yes to them. I'm going to see where that, and like, if they're a yes to me, I'm going to see where that yes leads. And it's very much this sense of, oh, there's something here that makes sense. I'm going to create space for it. And that can lead in beautiful directions. My friends who are romantic, they're much more, have this experience of, oh, I see a new person and I'm really drawn to them and I don't know why. And it's kind of overpowering. Like, I don't have that overpowering sense, but I still have a desire for a connection. So I tend to experience my relationships as just kind of taking one step in front of the other, as saying, oh, there's a way of spending time with this person that's going to make sense for me. I'm going to spend that time. I'm going to let the relationship become intentional as it becomes intentional, and then I'll see where things go from there.
You know, your chapter 6 in your book is entitled Why We Fail to Invest in Relationship. And you point out that it's hard to make a business case for it, or at least I read between the lines. Because why is that? Is because it's hard to monetize friendship? I mean, Facebook's trying.
Thank goodness it's hard to monetize friendship. But but in though if you think about it differently, it's not. So I'll give you an example. Research recently came out that said that the leading predictor of economic mobility is social connection, cross-class social connection. If you look at like cancer research, disease research, the leading predictor of scientific breakthroughs is novel relationships between fields.
Huh? Yeah.
And there is a lot of, you know, our economy needs resilience, it needs innovation, it needs a lot of things that relationship provides us. And I think that it's not that there's not an economic case for investing in relationship. It's that relationships, by their very nature, are unpredictable. If I do a good job of building relationship, if I'm being changed by someone and also changing them, I don't know at the beginning what's going to happen at the end. I can't predict where really good conversation is going to go. I can't predict where really good relationship is going to go. And our economy is often predicated on investing in things that have a predictable outcome, that have tight controls. And when you ask investors, philanthropists, whatever, to invest in something that's going to be really good, but that is by definition unpredictable, they are uncomfortable releasing that control. And I think that has resulted in a real underinvestment in relationship at a time where we're in a loneliness crisis and the world really, really needs it.
How do we solve that? How do we make it worthwhile to be invested in? Is that where movements come in? I mean, there's a lot in your book about how movements nurture relationship.
So movements to me are a real source of hope in the world. If I think about kind of corporations as, including nonprofits, as one way of arranging human labor and one way of mobilizing resources, social movements, whether you're talking about civil rights movements, queer liberation movements, feminist movements, environmental justice movements, movements have a really rich history of mobilizing people and mobilizing resources to get really incredible things done, motivated not by this sort of need for control and profit, but really driven by the mechanism of relationship. If you look at where movements, historically where movements start, they don't start where a bunch of people get angry and get in the street. So that is, can certainly be part of it. That's an important part of it. They tend to start at places where people are in deep relationship because they're supporting one another. Whether you look at the Berkeley Center for Independent Living, which was key to the start of the disability justice movement, or AME Zion Church with Dr. King and the Montgomery bus boycott. These are places where people already were coming together to connect, already coming together to support one another, and then that meant that their relationships had the power to stand up and create change in the world. And so I really think about that link between collective care and collective power.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's beautiful. And so we've only got like a minute left, and I want to let you have it in order to share a note of optimism about our future, if you can.
Gladly. So I think there are, you know, we talked about relational work. I see so many people out there doing incredible, underappreciated relational work. I see so many lineages, so many things that our ancestors, our grandparents knew that really have answers about how to build connections that can add the resilience, add the health, add the strength to our democracy that's really needed. And so for me, asking the question, what do I want the world to look like? But what relationships do I want to bring into the world if I want to transform? And how can I take little steps in my life to make those relationships possible? That focus on relationship has been incredibly empowering for me. And I hope that so some of the listeners today can put on that lens a little bit and think about what are some of the relationships that you can invest in building that can help to create the world you want.
Well, I think the first thing they should do is order your book, because it's got so much information, and we can't do it justice on a single pathway segment. But I really want to thank you, David. There's just so much more we could explore, but we've basically run out of time today. So thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And I want to be sure to tell our listeners about your website, where they can go find out about your book and your work. It's relationalitybook.com. Relationalitybook.com, all one word. And for those who may be listening to Pathways Live on a Sunday morning and have tuned in late, this is your host, Paul O'Brien, and we are so glad you are with us today. Please note that you have the ability to review this and hundreds of interviews in our online archive at divination.com. You can play and share this program whenever you want via the internet or as a free podcast, and I encourage you to do so, and I'll tell you how in a minute. Today, we've been visiting with David Jay, author of the book Relationality, How Moving from Transactions to Transformational Relationships Can Reshape Our Lonely World. I want to say a heartfelt thank you to all of you listeners for tuning into Pathways, which is currently broadcast on KBOO FM in Portland, Oregon. And you can get a free subscription to our podcast version, which you can also find at divination.com, and that's spelled divination.com, or by searching Pathways Radio on Paulo's YouTube channel, where you can also give us a thumbs up and subscribe. Feel free to forward a link to your friends. And this is Paulo bidding you adieu and reminding you to tell your friends about our show. And thanks again to David J. and to all of you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways Conversation.
Is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification